We finish up our series called Hope Rising today with the story of that really takes place after Elisha's death. So here it is. It's the 13th chapter of 2 Kings, starting in the 20th verse. So Elisha died, and they buried him. Now bands of Moabites used to invade the land in the spring of the year. As a man was being buried, a marauding band was seen, and the man was thrown into the grave of Elisha. As soon as the man touched the bones of Elisha, he came to life and stood on his feet. This is the word of God for us, the people of God. Thanks be to God. It's an incredible scene. It's a funeral. A family presumably have gathered to issue the rites at a graveside service, and as they are about to undergo the rites, they see a dust cloud in the distance as Moabites come in to raid, to take, to steal, to plunder. And so the family that is at this graveside service has a decision to make. Do they stand there and continue the rites, or do they run and go seek safety and go warn others of what is coming their way? And so they choose to run, and they toss the body haphazardly into this communal grave. But something amazing happens. The body brushes up against the bones of the prophet Elisha, and as soon as contact is made, this dead man comes alive and stands up. Now, there's two ways of looking at a story like this. One way is that Elisha was so powerful that even his bones raised people from the dead. Or God is so powerful that he can raise someone from the dead just through a dry old bone. Is this the story of Elisha? Or is this the story of God? Elisha is so much like Elijah that I will say the wrong name 50% of my efforts throughout this sermon. Elisha, Elijah, Elisha, Elijah. Elijah means God. My God is Yahweh. The Jah is like Yah, Yahweh. Elisha means my God is salvation. So very similar theological names. And they had really similar ministries. They both had produced miracles that fed people in times of scarcity. They both had risen people from the dead. We heard our first week of this series of Elijah doing it. And last week, if you were here, you heard about Elisha raising someone from the dead. Both men spoke truth to power. In a tumultuous time in Israel's history, they both were willing to speak out and speak true. But when Elijah's days were done, he was taken straight into heaven. Chariot of fire came down, and he jumped in the back, and off he went up into heaven, and he just dropped his mantle, kind of like the stoles that Martha and I wear, dropped that mantle to his follower, to his chief disciple, to Elisha. When Elisha's days were done, though, he got sick, and he died, and he was buried. Did Elisha do something wrong? Why was he not given this same sense of a send-off? He had asked for a double portion of Elijah's power, and he was granted it. And he did so many amazing things. In fact, there are more stories of miracles at the hands of Elisha than there are of stories of miracles from Elijah. So why didn't he get this farewell? It doesn't seem fair. It kind of reminds me of how I feel at the end of Deuteronomy, when Moses is looking out at the promised land. Moses, who had done so much, led the people out of Egypt. He had stayed with them throughout the 40 years in the wilderness. When they were hungry, he prayed for food. When they were thirsty, he prayed for water. He helped guide those people for decades. And then finally, they get up to look at the promised land, and he's out there looking. It's almost like God's just standing shoulder to shoulder with him, and God says, look out there and see all that beautiful promised land. I hope you enjoy the view, because you don't get to go. It doesn't seem right. Seems cruel. But what would have happened if Moses had been allowed to enter into the promised land? Seems like it could have gotten really easy for people to quit seeing Moses as one of them and to start to see Moses as divine? Would they have confused Moses' power with God's power, perhaps? If Moses' story is the story of Moses, then truly that scene of just seeing the promised land but not being allowed to enter is cruel. But if Moses' story is first and foremost God's story, well, then the end begins to make some sense. If the story of Elisha is really his own story, then it seems like he was denied something important. It seems like a cruel end. But if Elisha's story is really the story of God, then perhaps it starts to make sense too. Imagine if God had allowed for all of the descent of the prophets to be able to have the same send-off that Elijah had. Imagine if Elisha was given a chariot of fire, and then Elisha's successor a chariot of fire, and then from there to there, how would we be receiving these prophets today? We would be following them like they were demigods. We'd be hiding in the bushes like paparazzi trying to take pictures of them. Can you imagine when it came time, every generation, for the next prophet to jump into a chariot of fire? The crowds that would gather would be make a scene like Times Square in New York on New Year's Eve look small. Everyone would descend. We would watch. We'd take pictures. We'd take selfies. We would see these prophets as more than human. Can you imagine how godlike we would view these prophets? Were they able to have a send-off like that? We would be so focused on their power that we might not see the God who they were called to be emissaries for. It'd be like focusing on the power of Elisha's bones and missing the God behind the bones. Now, it's understandable that we tend to do that. We see people. We see people. We don't see the invisible God. And so it's easy sometimes to inadvertently project God on what we do see. If you if you're interested in having a laugh, I'd recommend putting on your funny hat and opening up the Bible to Acts chapter 14. I'm not kidding. It actually is funny if you let it be. It's a story where Paul and Barnabas have gone to Lystra, which is in modern-day Turkey, and when they get there, they see this man who has not been able to walk his whole life. And Paul looks at that man and says, "Stand upright on your feet." And that man, it's like he'd been thrown on the bones of Elisha. He stands right up and begins to walk. Now, all the people in Lystra see this happen, and their immediate response is, "The gods have come down among us. These two must be gods." And so they look at Barnabas, and they look at Paul, and they're like, Barnabas looks like he must be Zeus. And Paul, Hermes? And so they begin to worship them. And Paul and Barnabas are like, no, that's not what we're here for. We're just people. We're just people. And they continue to worship. And then suddenly, just outside of the town, at the temple of Zeus, the priests there hear about it. And so the priests bring some cattle, and they start going into town, and they try to sacrifice the cattle at the feet of Paul and Barnabas. And they're like, no, please stop. We do that all the time in a very different way. We confuse people we see with the invisible God. We do it with politicians. We do it with corporate leaders. We do it with our family. We do it with church members. We do it with pastors. Now, Elisha was a holy man, but it wasn't his own holiness that made him holy. It wasn't Elisha's bones that caused the resurrection. It was God behind the bones. It was the God behind the bones. Now, the other aspect that I think is really worth considering about why Elisha wasn't taken off with a chariot of fire is that when Elijah was ascending into heaven, he had a worthy successor in Elisha. He had recruited Elisha way back. He was walking along one day. He saw Elisha out in the fields. He had 12 oxen, and he was plowing the fields. And Elijah says to Elisha, whew, I feel like I need a jump rope getting through this. Elijah says to Elisha, "Hey, follow me." And Elisha says, "Great, I will, but let me go tell my family goodbye." And Elijah is really skeptical. He's like, "Hold on a second. Are you really going to be in for this? Are you really committed?" And so Elisha does something pretty gruesome. I'm not going to give you all the details, but basically he takes the yoke that was holding those oxen together and he chops it up, burns a fire, and then he transforms the oxen into barbecue. And he feeds the community with that barbecue. So essentially he has taken his entire livelihood and it has been consumed. He cannot go back. Elisha was all in. Now, Elisha then seemed to have found a worthy successor himself. If you were with us last week when we looked at Elisha's resurrection story, he had Gehazi, his chief servant, his disciple. And Gehazi was great. He's the one that suggested that they consider blessing that woman who didn't have any children with a child. And he's the one that ran ahead after the child had died. He ran ahead with that staff, if you remember that part of the story. So he seemed great. But then a little after that story, there was this man from another land. His name was Naaman. He was a general, and he was suffering from a skin disease. And Naaman had heard that there was a healer in these parts. And so Naaman came down. He made his way to where Elisha lived, and Gehazi went out to meet him. Elisha wouldn't even meet with him. Gehazi came out and said, the prophet says, if you want to be healed, you should bathe in the River Jordan 7 times. And you'll be healed. And Naaman is incensed. He's like, what? This is not worthy. God's not even speaking to me. He sent his servant out. I'm out of here. But one of his servants talks him into it. He goes into the River Jordan, bathes 7 times. Lo and behold, he's healed. Well, he goes up the hill and says, all right, great. This was fantastic. How much can I pay you? I've got a whole wagon full of money back here. And Elisha says, you cannot pay me. Don't even try. Just go back to your land, essentially, is what he's. It's not a quote, it's a paraphrase. But anyway, he says, get away, go on. And so Naaman starts to leave. Well, Gehazi sees Naaman leave. He sees the truckload of money, and he sneaks out. And he goes up to him and says, oh, the master has reconsidered. Could you give us a little bit of money? And so he takes a couple bags of money, hides it, and goes back in. Elisha says, Gehazi, where have you been? And Gehazi lies. Not a good idea with prophets. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. And Elisha says, you just went and took a whole bunch of money. Therefore, you get the skin disease. Zap! And he's got it. So Gehazi's out. No longer a good servant. It seems a little bit over the top, right? Like, why zap him with the skin disease? Well, think about it. He has gone for the low-hanging fruit of the tangible. He takes the money. And it turns what should have been a story about God's miracle into a mere transaction. He takes what should have been a story of God's miracle and it becomes a transaction. It's like he grabbed the bones instead of worshiping the God behind the bones. This is our constant temptation. We hold on to what is tangible instead of embracing the God behind what is tangible. We hold on to the ritual without remembering the purpose of the ritual. We hold on to the bones instead of the God behind the bones. I say that as a guy who wears the same pair of socks every Sunday. I wash them, I swear, but still, do we depend on the socks or do we depend on God? Do we depend on the bones? Or do we depend on the God behind the bones? We can't help it. We so often focus on the tangible and lose sight of the intangible. We focus on accomplishments and lose sight of the grace of God. We focus on our image and we lose sight of the important work of transforming our hearts. We focus on our bank accounts and our salaries and lose sight of God's generosity. Even our life of faith can be a place where we slip. Prayer can become the practice of ineffectual spells if we aren't having a relationship with God as we pray. Communion can become an inadequate snack if we aren't focused on the God behind the sacraments. Our Bibles can become a weapon if we aren't focused on the God that is the word that gives them power. We hold on to bones instead of the God behind the bones. Now, the man that was thrown into that communal grave was dead. And his body brushed up against the bones of Elisha, and he stood up. He came to life. But I don't think this story is about him. And Elisha's bones were the bones in that grave, but I don't think this story is about Elisha either. This is a story about God. About a God who is so powerful that that God can even use old bones to raise the dead. Is the story of your life going to be about you? If so, it will end in bones. But if you let your life be about God's story, then get ready to rise. Get ready to rise.